Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Hundreds of years ago, the early leaders of the Christian church came together to nut out in kind of a statement form the essentials of Christian belief. And they were wrestling with what the scriptures said about Jesus and things that almost sounded paradoxical. But in the end, they came down to this statement: he is truly God and truly man. It is kind of a paradox, but what they captured and what they defined in those creeds is actually found right throughout the Bible, especially in Jesus' miracles and also his claims about himself as well. If you grasp that idea that Jesus is both truly God and truly man, then this world and this life starts to look very, very different. In fact, according to Michael Frost, a radical rediscovery of Jesus in all his fullness changes the way that we think about God, about the church, and about the world. And it's those three things we're going to focus on now. Michael is the co-author with Alan Hirsch of Read Jesus, A Wild Messiah for a Missional Church. And he's back with us again. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be back.
This idea of Jesus being both fully God, fully man, seems to be something we've wrestled with. We've either kind of gone to one extreme or the other. Now, I want to unpack this whole idea of Jesus being those two things at once, and what happens when we kind of stray to one side or the other. So, firstly, what happens when we emphasize Jesus' divinity but kind of minimize his humanity? What happens to us practically?
Well, we end up worshipping Jesus as kind of holy other, as some almost supernatural being. And there are classic heresies around this. I mean, there was a heresy very early in the church's history where it was believed that Jesus wasn't actually really human at all. He was God pretending, masquerading, seeming to be human. I don't know if you've ever seen any of those movies where aliens appear and they take on the form, or the Terminator movies, you know, they're not really human, but they can just look human. And there was that idea. It actually became a theology, and it was rejected as being heretical. Otherwise, you end up with a Messiah who can't actually die. I mean, if you're not really human, if you don't really live, if you're just a kind of a bit of skin on a God being, or however you would think about that, if you are just like a Terminator or an alien or something, well, you're not really dying for the sins of the world. So that's why it was rejected as a heresy. So an overemphasis on the divinity of Jesus might not go so far as those heretics did, but in practical terms, it's as though, well, Jesus doesn't call us to an earthy, radical living out of his lifestyle. He calls us just to worship him and to adore him and to lift him up. Well, he does, but he calls us to something more. So the emphasis swings to the Jesus we adore rather than the Jesus we follow.
Which is a key phrase in your book, isn't it? The Jesus that we worship rather than the Jesus that we follow.
Yeah.
Okay, well, going the other side then, what happens when we emphasize Jesus' humanity but we minimize his divinity? What happens to us practically then?
Well, then we end up with a Jesus who's a great and radical teacher and who provides for us a good example of how to live and the like, but is no more than any other remarkable human being. I mean, if we either deny or we minimize his divinity, I mean, we could put him in the same camp as, you know, Gandhi or Martin Luther King or somebody like that. I mean, you know, a great and extraordinary person who did great and extraordinary things, made great sacrifices, all of that sort of stuff. You just put Jesus in that category. He's an incredible, remarkable human being. But the gospel doesn't let you get away with that. He is divine. It becomes quite clear in his own, as you mentioned in the intro to this, in his own statements about himself, as well as his authority and power over nature and illness and the supernatural, and as well, of course, ultimately in his resurrection from the dead, a physical resurrection. I mean, it's mysterious, I grant you. I don't want to give your listeners the impression, well, it's all very easy to understand. I mean, it is an extraordinary mystery, but the gospels don't ever let you off the hook. They don't allow you to jump one side or the other. You have to hold them both if you're going to be having a full appreciation of what the gospels say about
it. Yes. Now, what is the chemical reaction when we actually do bring those two together? We do hold together that Jesus is both divine and both human.
Well, the first one, I guess, comes to mind. We could talk about lots of things, but it tells us that God actually wants to draw near. I mean, God didn't just kind of send Jesus as his emissary. He's some very special human being, and I'll stay here far distant and away from you all, and you all stink and you're all disgusting, but here I'll send, you know, my emissary there. That's my representative. I mean, he embodies human flesh. He wades into all the garbage and nonsense of this world. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing. No other religion approximates that. I mean, the divine in any other religion is considered to be so pristine and so pure and so other that it cannot be contaminated by drawing near to the mess and garbage of human existence and life. But our God, in the biblical understanding, Jesus teaches us that our God actually took on flesh, didn't even just kind of get a little bit close, enters fully into the human experience and wades right into the worst mess you can imagine in life. And so it says something absolutely astonishing about the nature and character of God that he would dare to do such a thing. I remember going to a worship service in Texas, of all places, and in this church building they had brought in with a front-end loader, I think, this huge pile of wet garbage, not hard rubbish that you throw out the tip, but household garbage.
Yeah.
And the person who led the service led us in a communion feast by wading waist-deep into this rotting garbage and then reaching down and pulling out a loaf of bread that thankfully was wrapped in plastic, and then a bottle of wine in a brown paper bag, and saying, you know, of course the communion feast reminds us of Jesus' death and his resurrection, but it also reminds us that God didn't consider the mess and the garbage and the stench of this world such that he couldn't enter in, and not just enter in, but wade right into it. Now, the divinity of Jesus and the humanity of Jesus attest supremely to that truth.
Yes. So we bring those two together, and then things start to look very different. And in the book, you also mention how Jesus' divinity wrapped up in humanity actually gives us a picture of what true humanity can be, and in fact probably always from the beginning of time actually should be. You've got the Apostle Paul talks about Jesus being, you know, the last Adam. The first Adam was the one who actually sinned and fell, and as a result we've got brokenness, and we've got a sin-riddled world and sin-riddled bodies and sin-riddled minds, and yet Jesus is the last Adam. He's the perfect human.
Yeah, and have a look at him. He's this perfect human, and he's hanging out with prostitutes and tax collectors and sinners and all sorts of unsavory characters. And in fact, not just hanging out with them, they're drawn to him. They love him. I always find it astonishing that the people who most claim to be like Jesus are hated by the very people that couldn't get enough of the real Jesus. Now, what does that tell us about what humanity is meant to be like? It's not pietistic. It's not aloof. It's not this kind of condescension. I mean, Jesus wades in, as I said before, and people are drawn to him. This is what ultimate humanity is meant to look like: selfless, sacrificial, loving, just, kind, good. I mean, he is an image of what humanity was intended to be. But the other radical thing, of course, is he is the supreme representative of what God is like. Now, you know, some people are okay with the idea that Jesus is godlike, but I think what would disturb a lot of Christians is to reverse that and think of the other truth, and that is that God, therefore, is Jesus-like. Well, if God is Jesus-like, have a look at Jesus. I mean, Jesus is in flesh the visual representative, the approachable representative of the eternal, holy God. Well, he doesn't end up looking quite the way you might have imagined in that respect. He doesn't appear, sit on top of a mountain in this magnificent temple and invite people to come up to him if they want to. I mean, he's in there, right up to his ears in it. And that says something astonishing about the Christian view of what God is like.
Yeah. This is Open House right across the nation, theopenhouse.net.au. For the podcast of our chat with Michael Frost, this is the second in a four-part series that we're looking at who Jesus is, trying to strip away our kind of, you know, crusted images of him that we so often, I guess, are raised with, or we kind of take on, or the ones that we kind of create ourselves, finding out who he really is, and as a result, what that actually means for us and what that means for our lives. So it changes the way we see God. Jesus was not just God-like, but God is actually Christ-like. And I think of that verse in the book of Hebrews that says he's the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of his being. To take that seriously is really quite mind-blowing.
It really is.
So it changes the way we see God, who God is, not distant but actually close. But then it changes the way we see the church. Explore that.
Well, what it tells us is that contact does not equal contamination. That God can have contact with us. God can take on flesh. God can be fully human. But he's not diminished as God. I mean, he has contact with sinful human beings. Whereas the Jews at Jesus' time felt that if they ever even physically were touched by a Gentile, they then had to be ritually cleansed because contact had contaminated them in some way. What we discover here is that God can actually be human, engage with humans, even the dirtiest of humans, but not be contaminated, not be diminished by that. Well, what does that say for the church? It says that Jesus' people, therefore, ought to recognize that contact with the poorest or the dirtiest or the worst sinners of all doesn't necessarily mean that they are contaminated or diminished by that. Mm. We've got too much of a kind of an old temple approach to thinking about church. Like I said before, Jesus didn't appear and sit in a pristine temple way up in the clouds somewhere. He wades right into the gutters. Well, in a sense, Jesus' people should be the same, wading right into life and engaging with people. It doesn't mean, as I said, that every point of contact means that somehow, you know, we've been a so-called bad witness or that our faith has somehow, you know, been made shaky because of it. It promises the fact that the church is not a building or a temple or a pristine space, but an organic collection of human beings entering fully into the life around them for the purposes of seeing people released from bondage or fear or sin or death.
Yes. A theological word called holiness comes to mind when I think of what we've kind of been talking about, this kind of idea that if you're going to be holy, set apart, different, well, then you can't kind of be part of the world, you can't be connected with it. And again, I just think of my own journey into understanding what holiness, being separate in the name of Jesus, actually is. I realized that I had a very much a separation mentality, I guess. Yet I did look at the life of Jesus and recognized the most holiest person on earth, knocking about with sinners and tax collectors and prostitutes. And as you said before, it might have been last week, that actually they gravitated towards him. That's holiness.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, I'm not here saying go out, live any old way you like. I mean, no. Jesus makes it quite clear what kinds of values and what kind of moral code he invites his followers to embrace. What I'm saying is you can live out that moral code in close proximity to people who don't necessarily adopt it. Mm. Now, people often say to me, oh, hang on, so what if I was an alcoholic and I came to faith, I became a Christian and I, you know, I gave up booze and I'm, you know, getting my life sorted. Am I meant to go back with all my old mates and drink at the pub? And I say to that, well, we just have to be sensible about where our own weaknesses are or our predilections might take us. Of course, there's places that you'd want to avoid and resist. I mean, I'm not being silly about this, but I'm just saying, goodness sake, I mean, you can't sit on your veranda with your next door neighbour or you can't hang out with your mates. You can make choices about what you eat or drink or what you say or what you laugh at or how you behave. I mean, they're personal choices of commitment to following in the way of Jesus. But surely following in the way of Jesus also means doing that in close proximity to people who don't necessarily share those same values, and in some cases may not even congratulate you for those values, but so be it. God has revealed to us that he is a God who engages fully into the lives of humankind, and therefore so should the followers of Jesus.
Mm. So grasp this idea that Jesus is both fully God, fully human. It changes the way we see God, changes the way we see the church, and then it changes the way that we see the world. And you use a Latin phrase there, the Imago Dei.
Yeah, well, Imago Dei is the image of God. That's what the Latin term means. And it comes from not from the Gospels or the New Testament, but from the very earliest book in the Old Testament about human beings being made in the image of God. They bear something of the stuff of God. And though fallen, most of your listeners will know the story of, you know, Adam and Eve and serpents and fruit and fall and abandoning the values that God had intended for us and all of that sort of stuff. Well, that image of God in all human beings has been marred, it has been broken. Leonard Cohen said there's a crack in everything. And so, you know, we bear the image of God, but it's cracked. There's a crack in everything. That's the effect of sin across the world. But the image, though cracked, it's still there. I've got a friend who's a forensic scientist, and she said the first law of forensics is that every point of contact leaves a trace. I mean, everything you touch leaves fingerprints. Every piece of carpet you walk on leaves an impression. Everything you do leaves an impression of some kind. And so God has made, I believe, all human beings. So we've got his fingerprints all over us. So my concern, I think, is that for too long, the followers of Jesus have gone around trying to find out where the cracks are and point them out to everyone, and been less eager to go out and find out where the traces of the image of God are still present in people's lives. Mm. There are examples of goodness and kindness and love and grace all around us. Now, I'm not suggesting for a minute that that's exactly the way it should be. I've already pointed out there's a crack in it. It's broken. Yes. It's marred. But I'd want to suggest to you that just as Jesus can go out and, in a centurion, a pagan, a Roman, can say, I've never seen such faith in all of Israel. A Syrophoenician woman begging him, on behalf of her daughter, can say, I'm convinced by this argument. I mean, he is drawn to people beyond even the faith life of Israel and see something valuable in these people. All the more so we should be today.
Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating stuff again. Last week we looked at how our images of Jesus can get in the way of us really recognizing who he really is. And then this week, looking at how recognizing Jesus' divinity and humanity changes the way we see God, the church, the world. Next week, how this radical rediscovery of Jesus that we're trying to do impacts our spirituality, which I think will lead very nicely from where we've just gone. Mike, thank you. We'll speak to you in a week's time.
Good, thank you. I look forward to it.
Michael Frost, director of the Tinsley Institute in Sydney and author of Re-Jesus, A Wild Messiah for a Missional Church.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.